It gives me great pleasure to introduce to you your speaker for this evening. He is a man who has a lot of enthusiasm for this program. I met him last August at another convention, and I liked what he said. So, Jim, it's yours.
My name is Dr. Jim West. Hi. I'm an alcoholic, and I learned in medical school that you can enhance the effect by using other agents beside alcohol, and I learned this effect so well that by the time I reached Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a compound or multiple problem. I think most of the people who come into AA these days have had some experience with drugs. I drank really to meet my needs. I felt socially inadequate. I had a certain amount of interpersonal unrest and discomfort with other people, except very few. Drinking increased my sense of self-esteem, and apparently I needed these two things. But I didn't know it at the time, and it didn't seem important because I drank successfully for a long period of time. I learned in medical school that if you drank too much, you could take a thing called Benzedrine. Now there are all other kinds of things, forms of speed. You could take Benzedrine, and this would relieve any kind of a hangover. And if, of course, you took too much Benzedrine, you could allay this effect by taking Nembutal. We called them yellow jackets at the time. And I always had some in my pocket. Eventually, my drinking became such that it reconciled itself with the definition of alcoholism. I was a periodic drinker. I was capable of performing functions, and yet I had the unpredictable property of not knowing when I was going on a binge, and these binges would last for an indefinite period of time. Eventually, my wife said to me, unless you do something about this, I'm going to leave and take the two babies we have, and I think it was our five-year-old, and go home, go back to my mother's home where I can make some kind of a life for myself and these three children. I wasn't really too concerned about this. I was concerned about the disgrace this would bring about for me in the community and in my hospital setting. And she suggested an organization called Alcoholics Anonymous, which is horrifying to me at the time. I think she'd probably heard about this by reading Jack Alexander's article in Saturday Evening Post. At any rate, not because I wanted to, not because I was attracted to it, but because I was sort of cornered into it, I did inquire. I called a couple of people from Alcoholics Anonymous, and they came to visit me. One of them was a broker, a banker. The other one was an accountant. I felt that it was an extremely ridiculous setting. Here was I, a professional in the business of healing, and here were these two amateurs telling me what to do. However, I was rather surprised because they not only did not tell me what to do, they talked mostly about themselves. Rather disappointing. I was all ready to defend myself, and I didn't have to use my defenses. I remember my wife asked me what they said, and I think at that time I said, well, it's a secret organization. I can't make any disclosures at this time. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was sick. even though I had temporary periods of sobriety, I exercised my illness in its drunken phase by disappearing. And I remember one time when I was at the county hospital, my wife asked my roommate there to check the morgue, see if I might not be there. I attended a couple of AA meetings, and first of all, it wasn't a shock to anybody in this group that there was a doctor in attendance, nor did anyone look to me for expertise. In fact, nobody seemed to give a damn whether I was there or not. And I came and went through the motions and even learned the correct things to say in a group. First things first, don't take the first drink. Easy does it. But the periodicity of my drinking continued. At first I thought, well, I really don't care. But the remorse, which was so dreadful, and always is for the alcoholic, was such that it finally dawned on me that I was going to be one of the people in AA who cannot make it. And at this point, there occurred that phenomenon, surrender. Now, as a doctor, I've concerned myself with the disease alcoholism. It would only be natural that I would, although I'm a specialist in surgery and make my living as a surgeon in Chicago. But I do know a lot about alcoholism as an illness. And I look at it from the inside and also from the outside. And I'd like to share these ideas with you about what I think alcoholism is, certainly as it applies to me, and how I, at least, can get better. First of all, alcoholism is defined as an inevitably progressive disease, exquisitely predictable, that interferes with one's work, one's home life, one's health. If drinking in any way interferes with one's health, one's life at home, one's employment, he or she is an alcoholic. And if you can get by these things, if it interferes with your interpersonal relationships, he or she is an alcoholic. I was concerned about the causes of this thing that affected me. And I learned there is no known cause for alcoholism. It's like schizophrenia, like epilepsy, like other disorders for which there is no known cause. If there were, we would address ourselves to the cause and cure the illness. I learned there is no such a thing as a cause, nor is there a cure for alcoholism. The best we can settle for is an arrest on a 24-hour basis. We know what this means. I learned that knowledge about this illness in no way prevents it. I have some friends who are psychiatrists and are eminent in their field of psychiatry who became alcoholics practicing psychiatry. One, an eminent psychiatrist who conducted a hospital for alcoholism, who became an alcoholic during this time and had one of those most dreadful and subtle symptoms of the illness, which is the lack of ability to see it in himself. He defines it sort of this way. He says, pretend I'm a tuberculosis specialist and the radiologist technician is bringing x-rays here. So I look at him and I say, well, there's a x-ray of the chest. There's a cavity there, a spot here, a cavity here. That's tuberculosis. And the next patient, please, cavity, cavity, spot, cavity, tuberculosis. The next x-ray, cavity, cavity, spot. Well, that's my x-ray. That's not tuberculosis. In other words, in himself, he could not see this illness as he treated it in other people. he was exercising the mechanism of the insane. Denial. Denial. We know that about 1 out of 13 people in the United States who drink will become alcoholic. And in the Archdiocese, which is a Catholic organization of Chicago, the Cardinal asked me to address myself to alcoholism among the clergy, which includes priests, brothers, and sisters. The ratio of alcoholism among priests is higher than 1 out of 13. I don't know why. Does heredity play a role? Well, I have one example in mind. When I got into AA, my daughter was 5 years old. And because I was a disappearer, she never really saw me drunk around the house. She may have seen me sick as I came straggling in, but not drunk. And I've been on the program since she's been that age. She grew up, graduated from college, bright girl, entered the convent, became a sister, had a master's degree, or the equivalent of that in the convent, normally functioning person, felt that after 6 years of being a sister, that this was not really the life for her. She could probably express herself better outside the community. She drank a little bit before she went in with other college girls. But it posed no problem, she thought. She got out of the convent, and she was out for 2 years. She called me one day and she said, "Dad, I joined AA." And I said, "Did you?" She said, "Yes. My drinking was sick drinking. I recognized it. And I heard things that you said. And I didn't want to be the way it was making me be. And I was preoccupied with drinking." And she's been a member of AA now for about a year and a half, I believe. Here's a girl who didn't become an alcoholic on the basis of environment. Maybe heredity plays a role. I don't know. I do know this. 50% of alcoholics have one or two parents who were alcoholic. What makes an alcoholic sort of a person? Of course, we in AA don't really care, but because Bill and I and other doctors in AA are trained to think this way, we pay attention to the things that we know about it, and we conclude that the alcoholic is a kind of a person who carries with him a sense of unrest and discomfort. And that when he takes his first effective drink, it does something to him that imprints itself on his brain, and he is addicted. The alcoholic brings his addiction to the first drink. There lay within his being what we call the soil for addiction. The alcoholic, me, treats his own anxieties successfully for a long while with alcohol. That drug that you can get without a prescription that works great for anxieties and that dread and that interpersonal discomfort that takes place between the alcoholic and other people, and it works great for a long while. The alcoholic doesn't have what you'd call a set personality structure. The architecture of his makeup is normal, except more so. His traits include a low frustration tolerance, the inability to wait out some situation that must, in the future, be resolved. Many times he'll wreck a thing to relieve the suspense of it. A low frustration tolerance. The alcoholic is a sensitive person. His IQ is higher than normal. There isn't any doubt about it. In 1964, there were 5 Nobel Prize winners picked. 4 were alcoholics. In my work as the director of the alcoholism program in the Archdiocese of Chicago, I am called by the cardinal to see a priest in a rectory about whom he has heard, and I usually go and motivate this person. There's a rather direct method here. I ring the doorbell, and when the priest shows up, I say, "I'm Dr. West, the cardinal sent me, and I understand you have an alcoholism problem, and I'm going to tell you what to do about it." I know about alcoholism, and you don't. And I'm going to direct the treatment. Let me say, before I make the call, I have staffed the situation and have this man's background. It just saves a hell of a lot of time to do it this way. If I run across a priest who is not in the top 5% of his class in college, I suspect he may not be an alcoholic. This is not really meant to be humorous so much as to give you some concept of the kind of a person an alcoholic is. He's a perfectionist. He's an idealist. And because he sets for himself impossible goals, he feels guilty almost all the time. And anybody who feels guilty all the time or lots of the time has a low sense of self-esteem. Now, the alcoholic tries to treat this low sense of self-esteem by a high productivity level. And this is why many recovered alcoholics are fine doctors, bank presidents, run the best gas station in town, etc. They never completely convince themselves, though, of their own worth. But they try through a high productivity level. The alcoholic is also a scientist in the science of wishful thinking. Wishful thinking, this is sort of manipulation of the truth. This is the science of doing what you want to do and then making it appear reasonable. This is after. Rationalizing is part of this practice. Explaining to yourself first. Isolation is also part of the makeup of the alcoholic. These are normal traits except greatly exaggerated in the alcoholic. Isolation is not necessarily normal in all people, but it is not considered abnormal to be somewhat reserved. The alcoholic is beyond the pall of normal. He's in isolation. Here's why. The alcoholic, with a low sense of self-esteem, is incapable of really making any meaningful friendships. He can't open up to anybody. He carries a protective mechanism. He's got to. He can't let anybody really see him. And if you can't do this, you don't have any close friends. The alcoholic is the kind of a guy that will know hundreds and not one. However, when he's treating his own anxieties with that wonderful medicine, he is capable of rather successful interpersonal relationships at first. He does the things easily that he would love to be able to do without this stuff. The alcoholic is a loner. One of the things about an alcoholic, that's me, of course, impulsive, works in spurts. Now, one of the things I want to say parenthetically here is, look, everybody, I'm not talking about an alcoholic who's drinking now. I'm talking about the alcoholic who's not drinking anymore. The only symptom that we lose after we get on the program is intoxication. The rest of them we bring into the program with us. The rest of them we treat at our group meetings and our individual interpersonal helps with each other. And these are the things we carry to the grave. Well, if we didn't, we'd be able to drink again socially. I'm trying to identify with you people who've made the program, if there's such a thing. You've made it today. Who are on the program. I'm talking about you. These are the things that you and I never really lose. These things. We're impulsive. Work in spurts. And after we get on the program, many times adopt hobbies and beat them to death in about 2 months. It's been said that the alcoholic is a great three-inning man. The alcoholic has a tendency to be, because, see, alcoholics are warm people, fearful people, but they're depressed. They have exaggerated mood swings. Many times their depressed moods last a little longer than their periods of impulsive elation. The alcoholic is a sort of a depressed person much of the time. This is even after he has stopped that most obvious symptom, intoxication. It's interesting and really not difficult at all to diagnose a drinking alcoholic. A drinking alcoholic is a fellow who gulps drinks. And you might think I mean just whiskey drinks. No, an alcoholic gulps coffee, water, milk, Coke, whiskey, vodka. He's a gulper. He sneaks drinks. He's the kind of a fella, and we have him in the AMA, who at the convention has been down to the treatment center first. In other words, the chit-chat lounge, and has a deal with the bartender so that when he comes down with his pals from Memphis and says, let's have a martini, he gets a double. This is sneaking drinks. He arranges to get more than would be publicly known. The great hostess helper. Diagnostic of the alcoholic is his loss of control as to time, as far as drinking is concerned. I don't mean he's drunk in the morning. I don't mean that at all. What I mean is if I'm making rounds in my hospital and I run into a doctor and he said, Jim, I'd like you to see a case that I have over here, and it's 11 o'clock in the morning, and I smell booze on his breath and it's Tuesday, this man is an alcoholic. He's not drunk, but he's lost control as to the proper times to drink. He's treating these anxieties now, not at the normal time that he used to treat them at, when he says, I'll never drink before 5. I'll never drink without my wife. I'll never drink outside my home. I'll never drink inside my home. He's lost this sense. He's still functioning, but when I smell booze at 11 o'clock in the morning on the 5th floor at Cook County Hospital and another doctor has asked me in consultation, this guy gulps drinks and he sneaks drinks. Although I haven't seen him do it, he's got that other third absolutely necessary symptom. He's an alcoholic. Now, you know, the alcoholic early in the game, and this is like at the college level, has an increased physiological capacity for drinking. If your son drinks with his friends, but he's the guy that has to drive them home, his capacity is greater than it ought to be, it's a clue that he may be an alcoholic. It's the early alcoholic that brings those dull normals shuffling and stumbling home. They can't carry it like he can. And another thing about an alcoholic, diagnostic-wise, is that the alcoholic is preoccupied with alcohol. He plans social engagements. Oh, how familiar this is to everybody. He plans social engagements by how that liquor flows. You try to make it look normal. But if you have a choice of 4 places to go, you don't give a damn whether it's nice or hot or cold or what. The thing that determines whether or not it's the place to go is whether or not the alcohol is freely available. In other words, preoccupation, one's life is managed around this thing while you're still functioning, but long since home. Now, prior to this, I was talking about the alcoholic after he quits drinking. Now I'm talking about the alcoholic before he comes to AA. These are these prodromata of final disaster. There are some physical aspects of alcoholism which we're not really too concerned about. I would say this. Acute intoxication, by the way, is a dreadful thing. There's a 20% death rate to delirium tremens, acute alcoholic intoxication. It's a serious thing. As an AA, if you know of a person who's dreadfully ill from drinking for a long period of time and is undergoing shaky symptoms, I would certainly have a doctor's telephone number at hand. Sometimes it requires professional care to do this. Chronic disorders from alcoholism usually can be lived with for a long period of time. Even some advanced cirrhoses can, once the patient stops drinking, the patient can live a relatively normal life. The outlook for the alcoholic, I'm talking as a doctor now, who happens to be an alcoholic, looking at this disease from the inside and the outside, the outlook for the treatment of alcoholism from the standpoint of recovery, and by recovery, you and I know we mean arrest, is 50%. 50% of the people that are exposed to the very finest of treatment get better. Now, there are 15% more who are greatly improved. And since I've been in AA a long while, I've been very happy with people who are just improved. I used to think when I first got on AA that it had to be absolute perfection. But that isn't true. I know some families who are way better off because this fellow only drinks maybe 1 month out of 6 or 7. That's better than drinking 7 months. And we try and try and try and help this kind of a person. Maybe one day he will be one of those whose arrest is permanent. Now, one of the great parts about any talk is brevity, and we're going to make this one that way. I exercise that kind of a thing. I want to talk about treatment. The treatment. Alcoholism is a mental illness. It's a mental illness. There is no difference between the physiological makeup of the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic person, even microchemically. It's a mental illness. How do we get better? By restoring ourselves through some medium to mental health. Now, if we're going to talk about getting better, let us just for a minute or two consider what mental health is. All mentally ill people have a common characteristic. They deny the reality of the world about them. All mentally ill people do this. What is reality? It's not some goofy abstract concept up here that some philosopher perhaps devised. No, here's what reality is for you and me. The rules, the regulations, the norms of conduct for your cultural setting, and the laws of the land. This is reality. And you live within that framework. The normal cultural characteristics of your group. Those are normal. This is reality. How do we meet these framework of reality? By living within the framework of those rules, regulations, and laws and norms of conduct. Things necessary that a person have mental health. 2. and he has to have both. The first, in mental health. Everybody. He has to be involved with other people. Involved with other people. At least, and this one person has to be acutely conscious of the person. And with whom our patient is involved, must himself be responsible. And from now on, sanity and responsibility are synonymous. In other words, to have mental health, a person must be involved with a responsible, sane person. If I were involved with one or two friends, but they were both criminals, this is not meeting the requirements for mental health. They are not responsible people. Seven drunks who are all friends of each other are not meeting this requirement. None of them are responsible. But there must be involvement in order to be mentally well with other responsible people. That's one requirement. The other requirement for mental health is that one have a strong sense of one's own worth. One has to be convinced of one's own worth. You can see how sick people are when they come to this program. How does one acquire a sense of one's own worth? Because it can be done. It's done by living according to an acceptable standard of behavior and developing a history of having lived according to an acceptable standard of behavior, and lo and behold, the patient eventually believes, I am a worthwhile person. You know that you cannot think yourself, but you can live yourself into right thinking. This is that first situation where, again, almost a good person, and eventually you are a good person. A person with a low sense of self-esteem can go through the motions of trying to do what's right and normal, and eventually this becomes part of them. This is the AA program, of course. Two requirements for mental health: to be involved with other responsible people, or to be loved and be loved. That's the other way to put it. And to have a sense of your own worth. Okay. How do I, as an alcoholic, try to accomplish this? First of all, I have to admit that I'm an alcoholic and a benzodrine taker and an Imbutol taker and all the kind of things that made me do. Geez, I hated to do that. It was irreconcilable for me to admit that I was an alcoholic and a pill taker. You know, when I first got in AA, I used to talk about that I was an alcoholic, talk about being an alcoholic at the group with all these tough guys from the steel mill on the south side of Chicago, the only group on the south side of Chicago. And they talked about drinking and all the things, other things I did. I was too ashamed to admit that I took those dirty, rotten, sneaking pills. And I thought, geez, I wonder if they found out I was taking pills, would they throw me out of this organization? You know, drinking is a sort of a semi-humorous thing. But taste tall. There's really nothing sort of pathetic about drinking. But taking pills evokes almost nothing but contempt. At least that's the way it seemed to me. I admitted I was an alcoholic. And I was very fearful of my anonymity. I'm not anymore, but something's really happened. In my hospital, where I was chief of staff and head of the Department of Surgery. I say that because, you see, I'm trying to team, and that's what happened to me. I didn't tell anybody I was a member of AA. It was like, you know, let's forget it and maybe it'll blow away. But as the years went by, it became clear that there's this conspiracy afoot in my hospital. Every man on the staff and most of the nurses and administrators, I'm a member of AA, but they're extremely careful to keep it a secret from me that they know it. I know because every now and then someone who seems so remote from the idea of his knowing that I'm an AA will ask me to step out in the corridor while he tells me about his brother. I had to abandon myself to the 12 steps of AA when I finally got it. When I finally thought I was going to be one of those that couldn't make it. Not couldn't make it, I was going to be one of the ones that would never make it. This was surrender to me. This was the bottom. But I couldn't say, wait a minute, let's take those 12 steps. I want to look them all over. I want to think them out and see if they'll work for me. No. I had to abandon myself to them and hope that they would work. Now, part of my work as a surgeon, you see, I'm a surgeon to make a living and keep my house warm and all that, and then I do these other things alcoholic-wise as part of my AA. It's my privilege to be a doctor so that I can do something with my MD to help alcoholics, but I don't do that as a living. Part of the thing I do as a living is heart surgery. And I, along with a team of heart cardiologists who don't do surgery, I operate on and I implant in their hearts a metallic device attached to a cable that I bring out through the neck and bury a battery in their chest wall. And this little battery has a mechanism in it that fires a very mild shock into the heart muscle 60 times a minute. Most of these patients are extremely ill. Many of them have a disease of the heart that interferes with its rhythm and with its beat, that unless they had this thing, they would not survive right without losing consciousness because their hearts do not beat fast enough to move that circulation. I mention this because these people depend on this pacemaker that I put in them in the way I have to depend upon the 12 steps of the AA program. The dependence is total. It isn't an option. It's total. My survival and sanity depend upon my abandonment to these 12 steps. I see the program in three contexts, three phases. It's a spiritual program. It's a psychological program. When this program was given through inspiration, spiritually, to Bill and Bob, God didn't decide to take every alcoholic and point the finger to him, have a puff of smoke appear, and have that fella get better. No. As the Lord does in most instances, he uses the natural means to bring about some kind of an effect, and he does it through psychological and sociological means. Here's what I mean by that. First of all, the program is spiritually based. I know that my relationship with God has to be such that it's continuous and permanent. The communication between me and God has to be open. I can destroy that communication line by deviating from what I know is His will for me. What is His will for me? My conscience will tell me every damn time. I have a little latitude because I'm so weak, I suppose, or dumb or something, because I can move off and get back on, and that line is still there. I'm afraid to try it often, and I don't give a darn about trying it often. That line of communication is my lifeline. This is a spiritual relationship between me and God. I know there's nobody in the medical profession that can get me better. There's nobody human that can get me better. There's no medicine that will get me better. I have to depend upon a supernatural being. But that communication line has to be open. My relationship with God, at first rather warm and comforting when I first got on, now is realistic and rather factual. And sometimes I miss that warmth. I don't get that surge that I used to. But it's there. I'll tell you how I know it's there, because when it gets sort of weak, I can feel it going. When I do something that is not part of these 12 steps, that line gets a little less distinct. Let me tell you something about the spiritual life briefly. Dr. Gustav Jung, from the standpoint of, wrote these things. He said, during the last people from all the civilized countries of the earth have come to me. Among my patients in the second half of life, that is to say over 35, there has not been one whose problem in the last resort was not that of finding a religious outlook on life. It is safe to say that every one of them fell ill because he had lost that which the living religions of every age have given their followers, and none of them has really ever been healed who did not regain his religious outlook. I'm talking about all these mental diseases, not just alcoholism. The psychological tools in AA. I endeavor, with pencil and paper, to write down defects in the fourth step and communicate with someone else about these defects in the fifth step. And you'll notice what's happening now. My restoration to mental health is beginning to develop because I am becoming involved with another responsible person. Exteriorizing these things doesn't get rid of them, but it puts them out where I can see them. And if I say it out loud, oh, believe me, just telling God is not enough. That's the spiritual part of those normal psychological means. Remember, God designed this mind and this psychological technique of where you talk about these defects to another person out loud. So that voice rings off the wall. It can be in a private room, but you got to say it out loud. As a therapeutic effect, if it is not done, probably will only be temporary. Temporary? 5 years, 10 years, but temporary. There is a deficit in therapy if that does not take place. Therapeutic effect of the 12 steps in the fourth step and in the fifth step. And then in that appeal to grace, God, I am a liar at heart, and I've told my sponsor, I'm still lying. If it is your will you take this kind of a thing from me? God does, to the point where I can get by. My insides aren't such that I have to relieve it by drinking. I am released from those things that make drinking mandatory for me. Sociologically, oh well, that's too damn long a word. The social part of the program is such that we become part of a group. That isolation. See, we don't have to worry about keeping the doors closed anymore. We have told people everything, well, almost everything, and eventually everything. We have nothing to hide. We are able to once more bring about and create meaningful relationships with other responsible people and satisfy a requirement for mental health. And not only that, but that exquisite thing that happens to the alcoholic. We develop the ability through our experience to help another suffering person through an empathetic relationship wherein we are the giver instead of the taker. friendship. Friendship requires mental health. So, our reference point is the AA program. Our dependence is on God. Thank you. And he has to have both. The first, I'm talking about normal people and mental health. Everybody. He has to be involved with other people. Involved with other people. At least one. And this one person has to be acutely conscious of the person. And this person with whom our patient is involved must himself be responsible. And from now on, sanity and responsibility are synonymous terms. In other words, to have mental health, a person must be involved with a responsible, sane person. If I were involved with one or two friends, but they were both criminals, this is not meeting the requirements for mental health. They are not responsible people. Seven drunks who are all friends of each other are not meeting this requirement. None of them are responsible. But there must be involvement in order to be mentally well with other responsible people. That's one requirement. The other requirement for mental health is that one have a strong sense of one's own worth. One has to be convinced of one's own worth. You can see how sick people are when they come to this program. How does one acquire a sense of one's own worth? Because it can be done. It's done by living according to an acceptable standard of behavior and developing a history of having lived according to an acceptable standard of behavior, and lo and behold, the patient eventually believes, I am a worthwhile person. You know that old AA thing? You cannot think yourself into right living, but you can live yourself into right thinking. This is that situation where you can begin to almost imitate a good person, and eventually you are a good person. A person with a low sense of self-esteem can go through the motions of trying to do what's right and normal, and eventually this becomes part of them. This is the AA program, of course. Two requirements for mental health: to be involved with other responsible people, or to be loved and be loved, that's the other way to put it, and to have a sense of your own worth. Okay, how do I, as an alcoholic, try to accomplish this? First of all, I have to admit that I'm an alcoholic, and a Benzedrine taker, and an Nembutal taker, and all the kind of things that made me do. Geez, I hated to do that. It was irreconcilable for me to admit that I was an alcoholic and a pill taker. When I first got in AA, I used to talk about that I was an alcoholic, talk about being an alcoholic at the group with all these tough guys from the steel mill on the south side of Chicago, the only group on the south side of Chicago. And they talked about drinking and all the things they did. And I talked about drinking and some of the things I did. I was too ashamed to admit that I took those dirty, rotten, sneaking pills. And I thought, geez, I wonder if they found out I was taking pills, would they throw me out of this organization? You know, drinking is a sort of a semi-humorous thing. But taking drugs, that's not humorous at all. There's really nothing humorous about drinking, but there's something sort of pathetic about drinking. But taking pills evokes almost nothing but contempt. That's the way it seemed to me. I admitted I was an alcoholic. And I was very fearful of my anonymity. I'm not anymore, but something's really happened. In my hospital, where I was chief of staff and head of the department of surgery, I say that because, you see, I'm trying to increase my sense of self-esteem, and that's what happened to me. I didn't tell anybody I was a member of AA. It was like, you know, let's forget it and maybe it'll blow away. But as the years went by, it became clear that there's this conspiracy afoot in my hospital. Every man on the staff and most of the nurses and administrators know I'm a member of AA, but they're extremely careful to keep it a secret from me that they know it. I know because every now and then someone who seems so remote from the idea of his knowing that I'm in AA will ask me to step out in the corridor while he tells me about his brother. I had to abandon myself to the 12 steps of AA when I finally got it. When I finally thought I was going to be one of those that couldn't make it. Not couldn't make it, I was going to be one of the ones that would never make it. This was surrender to me. This was the bottom. But I couldn't say, wait a minute, let's take those 12 steps. I want to look them all over. I want to think them out and see if they'll work for me. No, I had to abandon myself to them and hope that they would work. Now, part of my work as a surgeon, you see, I'm a surgeon to make a living and keep my house warm and all that, and then I do these other things alcoholic-wise as part of my AA ministry. It's my privilege to be a doctor so that I can do something with my MD to help alcoholics, but I don't do that as a living. Part of the thing I do as a living is heart surgery. And I, along with a team of heart cardiologists who don't do surgery, they select the patients that I operate on, and I implant in their hearts a small metallic device that's attached to a cable that I bring out through the neck and bury a battery in their chest wall. And this little battery has a mechanism in it that fires a very mild shock into the heart muscle 60 times a minute. Most of these patients are extremely ill. Many of them have a disease of the heart that interferes with its rhythm and with its beat, that unless they had this thing, they would not survive for long. And many of them can't even sit upright without losing consciousness, because their hearts do not beat fast enough to move that circulation. I mention this because these people depend on this pacemaker that I put in them in the way I have to depend upon the 12 steps of the AA program. The dependence is total. It isn't an option. It's total. My survival and sanity depend upon my abandonment to these 12 steps. I see the program in three contexts, three phases. It's a spiritual program. It's a psychological program. When this program was given through inspiration, spiritually, to Bill and Bob, God didn't decide to take every alcoholic and point the finger to him, have a puff of smoke appear, and have that fella get better. No. As the Lord does in most instances, he uses some kind of an effect, and he does it through psychological and sociological means. Here's what I mean by that. First of all, the program is spiritually based. I know that my relationship with God has to be such that it's continuous and permanent and open. The communication between God has to be open. I can destroy that communication line by deviating from what I know is His will for me. What is His will for me? My conscience will tell me every damn time. I have a little latitude because I'm afraid to try it often, and I don't give a darn about trying it often. Communication is my lifeline. This is a spiritual relationship between me and God. I know there's nobody in the medical profession that can get me better. There's nobody human that can get me better. There's no medicine that will get me better. I have to depend upon a supernatural being, but that communication line has to be open. My God, at first rather warm and comforting when I first got on, now is realistic and rather factual, and sometimes I miss, I don't get that surge that I used to. But it's there. I'll tell you how I know it's there, because when it gets sort of weak, I can feel it going. When I do something that is not part of these 12 steps, that line gets a little less distinct. Let me tell you something about the spiritual life briefly. Dr. Gustav Jung, probably the greatest psychiatrist, from the standpoint of effective psychiatry, wrote these things. He said, during the last 30 years, people from all the civilized countries of the earth have come to me. Among my patients in the second half of life, that is to say over 35, there has not been one whose problem, one of them fell ill because he had lost that which the living religions of every age have given their followers, and none of them has really ever been healed who did not regain his religious outlook. I'm talking about all kinds of mental disease, not just alcoholism. The psychological tools in AA. I endeavor, with pencil and paper, to write down defects in the fourth step and communicate with someone else about these defects in the fifth step. You'll notice what's happening now. My restoration to mental health is beginning to develop because I am becoming involved with another responsible person. Exteriorizing these things doesn't get rid of them, but it puts them out where I can see them. And if I say it out loud, oh, believe me, just telling God is not enough. That's a spiritual part of the program. But God also says, let's use those normal psychological means. Remember, God designed this mind and this psychological technique of the, you talk about these defects to another person out loud. So that voice rings off the wall. It can be in a private room, but you've got to say it out loud. Has a therapeutic effect if it is not done. Sobriety probably will only be temporary. Temporary? 5 years, 10 years, but temporary. There is a deficit in therapy if that does not take place. The cycle that does to the point where I can get by. My insides aren't such that I have to relieve it by drinking. I am released from those things that make drinking mandatory for me. Sociologically, oh well, well, the social part of the program is such that we become part of a group. Ah, that isolation. See, we don't have to worry about keeping the doors closed anymore. We have told people everything. Well, almost everything. And eventually, everything. We have nothing to hide. We are able to once more bring about and create meaningful relationships with other responsible people.
and satisfy a requirement for mental health. And not only that, but that exquisite thing that happens to the alcoholic, we develop the ability through our experience to help another suffering person through an empathetic relationship wherein we are the giver instead of the taker. Friendship. Friendship requires mental health. So, our reference point is the AA program. Our dependence is on God. Thank you.